AI.
Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Today we dive deeper into two of the main news topics of the year, the deadly COVID-19 pandemic and the widespread movement against police violence and racism. Later in the show, we'll talk to a Pinellas teacher who is concerned about the push to reopen in-person classroom education despite record coronavirus infections in Florida. Are you a parent, student, school worker, or teacher? What do you think? But first up, we'll hear from the Dean of Stetson University College of Law about a new consortium for racial justice between all of Florida's 13 law schools. And we'll take your calls. Here's how you can join in the conversation. You can phone 813-239-9663. You can email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. If you text us, please put your name on the text. The Tampa Bay area has seen a wave of demonstrations against police violence and racism since the death in May of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. With this backdrop of a massive racial justice movement around the world, the 13 law schools in Florida have joined to form what they're calling a consortium for racial justice. To find out more about this partnership, I spoke with the Dean of Stetson University College of Law, Michelle Alexandri.
WMNF Dean Michelle Alexandri, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're fairly new at Stetson Law. Why don't you tell our listeners who haven't heard from you yet just a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and what sorts of law issues you're interested in?
This is my second year at Stetson. I just started my second year, and I am new to Florida, that is true. And my background is that I was on faculty at various institutions, most recently from the University of Mississippi School of Law, where I spent about 12 years, and then before that, University of Memphis. I practiced civil rights in Alabama before joining the academia, and I, you know, like many of my colleagues, I clerked with a federal judge and also worked at a big law firm at the inception of my career. But I knew that I wanted to do civil rights law, social justice work, which led me to the Black Farmers' work with my law firm, the smaller law firm that I joined in Alabama, and it's just taught me so much about lived realities and how to really bridge the gap between law and real life.
And those farmers that you're talking about, those were in the Mississippi Delta?
That was a national lawsuit. This was a lawsuit that had two iterations, one under President Clinton and one under President Obama. And the essence of it is that the agencies that regulate farming and loans to farmers, the USDA had been documented as having discriminated against farmers based on race, but the evidence didn't come through until much later. So President Clinton issued a consent declaration and gave the impetus for a consent decree under federal court for the court to administer how that those kind of issues would be unearthed and the kind of remedy. So it was one of the really important instances where a large group of people was able to get some relief, the cause generation, even though the events themselves had occurred prior.
And you're one of the deans of 12 law schools in Florida that are announcing the Florida Law Schools Consortium for Racial Justice. What is that?
Absolutely. So my colleague and I, Laura Rosenberg from University of Florida, and you know, in my good background, obviously, I've always come to the state that I've lived in Alabama and in Mississippi and now Florida, wanting to really understand the role of institutions to that state, to that locality. And there's so much great opportunities in Florida, so much history there. So I reached out to Laura, and she's such a great collaborator, and she reached out to her alum, I reached out to my alums, and really the question that we posed was, how could law schools be of use in this time? And we really heard from our various cohorts that what we do well in law school is what the state could use. The first leg is education and really stepping into the role of lawyers to educate lawyers as citizens, as well as practicing advocates, that role, the lawyer of citizen, which the profession imbues lawyers with responsibilities that are above that of any average person by virtue of determining and choosing this profession. And we are lucky that the code of conduct in Florida is actually very strong in that department. So we came together as a group, all 12 law schools, and leaned on the professional code of conduct of the Florida Bar and really fleshed out what we thought we could contribute. That includes, in addition to educating and training facilitators, you know, helping our students develop facilitation skills around tough conversation, researching issues related to social justice and racial justice in Florida. One of the big important contribution we want to make ourselves available to facilitate is to dynamic organization, very important organization working on these issues across the state. We know that the Florida Bar, for example, did an extensive review of the criminal justice system. There's so much work even in that document to help amplify, to help support, to provide resources for research. We have our own localities and partners, and we're welcoming new partners. So in that consortium, we wanted to make ourselves available, but also make a call for partnership to community members working on these issues. You know, our pro bono structure, our clinical structures, our research structures and law schools are just great conduit to make that work possible and that those collaborations possible.
Our guest is Michelle Alexandre, the Dean of Stetson University College of Law, and we're talking about the Florida Law School's Consortium for Racial Justice, which was recently founded with all 12 law schools in the state of Florida. I take it that students will be involved, law students. What will some of those students be working on? What are some of the ideas that you can address racial justice? What are some issues that might be addressed?
We'll pick the projects, and we imagine some of the projects are two a year, and then all of the students, let's say law school, each law school identifies one student, and then we all join around a project. So one project that the Stetson College of Law has undertaken in the past with collaborators is the Fees and Fines Project. You know, all jurisdictions have documented in the last few years a correlation between poverty, race, and the amplification of fines, creating a debilitating cycle that ends up having people go to the justice system unduly and being penalized beyond the original infraction, which could be a stop, etc. So our law school really is passionate about projects like that. The ability to amplify that work, we've collaborated with bar associations. For example, our current collaborators range across the board, Menace Bar and all of our various local bar associations. But we also collaborated, our faculty members are collaborating with Florida Bar. We'd like to amplify projects like that, key issues around juvenile detention, criminal justice, that we know. The thing about Florida is that so many wonderful people are working in localized groups on that. And we have the research entities of the schools doing that work. And like our veteran clinic, for example, serving disenfranchised population, the power of having all the law schools identify that one issue and levying all the resources of the law school to that issue, and then really supporting the work of the expert, which are the community organizations. We provide a very specific set of skills, which is the research, the resources, and also the ability to train lawyers for a particular comprehensive purpose rather than, you know, singular myopic purposes. But we understand that this work of social justice takes everyone. So we want the partners to feel empowered, to be at the table. So we don't want any hesitation around what we think our mission is. So whether it is to the organizations or to the programs that we'll put together, the symposia we'll put together, or our own initiative, we already know like a particular key issue in the criminal justice system is just so wide to, and so ready to be tackled in small bite pieces. And we also know legislators who are eager to have that collaboration. We've collaborated at different times with legislators before. So training our students to write policies and support policies that can contribute to that work is very key. But one example that could be fun, and because it's also historical, it's looking at the past and linking it to the present, that the students are very concerned with and passionate about, that we want to help support. And that is to really research the historical legacy of Jim Crow and to a certain extent, in some parts of Florida, even slavery, right? Florida is unique in its history. So the way that historical deep dive maps out doesn't apply to like a place like Mississippi, for example, where you have more of consecutive narrative of what slavery was. But even with that, we have such a powerful legacy of how the present and the past, how they are entangled. And new generations or even newcomers or even residents, unless it is, the information is right there in a sequence, you don't always know, and you don't always know what things are the way they are and what the possibilities for changing them. So there are key projects we've already identified, at least at Stetson, that students are eager to take part of, that we want to connect with other schools. And I know our colleagues, the other 11 colleagues, feel the same way. And that's the unique part of higher education, that we have large cohorts of researchers, which among them will be happy to kind of shepherd and help the students, help organization, really, you know, ask the issues about in Tampa Bay. What is the history around the green benches and how does that manifest in the way we see green, the way we choose green, and who belongs, who doesn't belong, and how is that related to our own institution? So we want that work to be internal as well as external. And I know Tampa Bay has already started that work around the green benches. The history in Tampa Bay is so unique, but presents points of intersection for all of us in Florida. And I think we have a beautiful story to tell. I look forward to us hopefully contributing to kind of a more organic, a deeper version of our collective history together in Florida.
Our guest on WMNF 88.5 is Michelle Alexandre, the Dean of Stetson University College of Law. One other topic that you might look at when it comes to your consortium for racial justice with all of the Florida law schools, and you touched on this briefly, is juveniles in juvenile detention. And one initiative you may be considering, that is the process by which juveniles are charged as adults. Why would that be something important to look at when it comes to racial justice?
That's absolutely important. I know many people around the nation now, people are reading about the criminal justice system and its inception and how the black body, the black juveniles are particularly adulterized, right? They are made into adults before they reach adulthood. And that means that they are more likely to be sanctioned at school, more likely to see that as a danger. And that also happened around black bodies, juvenile bodies generally. We have really deep records now documenting the way young black people in school. So you would say black girls. I try to be gender neutral and I say young black women, the younger demographic. And that's just me and my work in progress. It's not me limiting anyone's use of that word. But, you know, that record, social science record, is very deep, but we still catching up. So the Supreme Court has been good in documenting in the death penalty cases, the recent ones, the maturity of the brain, and how much it is limited before the age of 25. They've used that neural science data to really move the death penalty for juvenile off the table, and then I've even gone as far as look at long sentences without parole, life sentence without parole, and push back against that. That's been a huge, and we have to credit, of course, Brian Stevenson for that work, because he's led those cases in court. And we have so much, because law in the United States is very much localized. So by the time something gets to the Supreme Court, so much harm can be done. And there's a lot of police power within the state. So the question for all of us is, how are we policing? And are we policing in a way that really is allowing children to be children? That means that they do make mistakes, but that they are not sanctioned to death by virtue of treating them like adults, when we know at 14, 15, 16, 17, or even 18, the brain is not as developed as a 25-year-old. And we see that adulterization even earlier than that in many areas. And it's not one state's fault. I want to highlight that. That data is pervasive around the country, and that's because there's a deep history linked to how we view bodies and who is criminalized at an early age. So education around that is something the 12 law school can do. Our students are coming passionate about doing justice in a holistic way. and target and understanding these issues and understanding the pitfalls. So arming them with that information, with that ability to do research with the infrastructure of communities who are in proximity with those issues, so that law schools are not doing edicts, that they are working as partners. That is what we hope could push the envelope. Our dream here, and we've been talking to our local community organization, is to work on pipeline projects that could break the school to juvenile to prison pipeline, that could interrupt it, intervene in it by providing educational outlets and models for these students who are deemed already on a course based on perceptions of their danger and their non-compliance to society's rules. And we have been in conversation. And for example, when we get on our feet together for this consortium, getting the funding to do something like that from all of our localities, that would be used to, pipeline and investing into, and when we say K-12, we mean as early as middle school even, to give that model, to supplement that education in a way that, inspiring and really interrupting the kids' own sense of self to the extent they've been told that they are in danger, that they need to perform a particular way. So there's so much work to do there. But I also want to highlight that we are aware that all the work is also internal. So part of our work is to interrogate ourselves in our institutions. So we're having conversations. I'm pretty sure that right now at any moment in all our schools, we're having these conversations because that is the conversation. It's internal to ask what the institution has done, how is the institution owning, and how much work is left to be done. So it's never a perfect thing, right? So we don't put out this consortium as us solving the problem, because if the problem could be solved, it would have been solved 400 years ago. It is us helping to advance by having difficult conversation about what we can do better internally to reflect our commitment, including parts of our culture that we could progressively help change. And we know all of this is a series of both conversation, action, step, and time to really make sure we're implementing structures that are lasting. We also want to interrogate the legal profession. So in the legal profession, generally, there are low numbers of Black attorneys, very low numbers of attorneys of color. And then when you look at particular states in Florida, the number of African-American attorneys is very, very low. So that is a crisis, that when you don't have even representation come close to what the proportion might be in the state, the question becomes, what is it that we could do better? How can inclusivity be more meaningful in our profession itself? So we want to be part of that conversation. We want to be part of creating opportunities, identifying talents early, providing resources, and we're calling on partners to help us do that. And we are committing to asking ourselves the hard questions, every hard questions you can imagine. We are asking ourselves, and knowing that perfection is not something that is quick coming. It is something that has to be worked on until we all have a more perfect relationship together.
Stetson University College of Law Dean Michelle Alexandre, I want to ask you about your reaction to the protests around the country, also around the world here in the Tampa Bay area, since the death of George Floyd. How do you think that those demonstrations have changed the narrative around racial justice?
That's a great question. I've talked to our students here and to various folks about how this is a pivotal moment. And I think of it as everyone having a role in society and everyone being called to mission for some purpose. That's something that I hope law schools is helping to refine in law students and in our community, right? Our staff, our faculty, every period. What is our mission? How are we living up to that? And at this moment, we have been called to mission collectively in the United States to progress the issue of inclusion. So what I think this moment is providing is having a conversation from all aspects of society, confirming exactly what has been, the research is replete with, my colleagues from a generation, the critical race theorists have been documenting this in law for decades now. And in a society, culture, progresses, and then it comes to a crescendo where those questions are happening. And I love the fact that I'm part of a tradition where in the United States, even though we have always been struggling for a more perfect union and a more perfect understanding of our flaws, right, from the original constitution that had to be amended in order for meaningful inclusion and racial justice to be created. To this period, the civil rights movement in the 1960s was another form of that conversation. And I've been sensing, and we've been talking about it because that conversation really is now at its height, but it's been underway for quite a while now. And now I hope we all now bought into it in a way where we want to learn more. At our school, we like to say that we are lifelong learners and that there is no one who is immune from having to learn. And that includes me, that includes everybody. And we have created at our school a reading group at our law school where we are reading texts together and then meeting, dedicating our summers outside of our schedules, et cetera. And that includes faculty, that includes staff. We hope that the students, when they come back, will be able to do that as well. And we are dedicating that time to understand where our points of blindness, our points of failure to coalesce, to intersect, really are. And some of it is as basic as defining our terms and understanding what we don't understand. And that also, that a lot of the hurt comes from people being afraid of talking about the issues. From that to us having what we hope is the all school kickoff to this, to the consortium where we are going to gather all the students and we start this educational process by having them see the models and then having students join us to talk about key issues that we will identify to start then working on, but also a holistic view about from our collaborators about the legal profession, what it offers and our specific responsibility to the state and the nation at this time.
Our guest is Michelle Alexandre, Dean of the Stetson University College of Law, and we're talking about their new Florida Law Schools Consortium for Racial Justice of the 12 law schools. And I want to wrap it up pretty soon, but why don't you give us an update of what the status of Florida's Amendment 4 is, which restored the right to vote to returning felons. It's tied up in courts right now, but what's the latest and what do you think will be the legally just outcome?
Ah, that's another huge question, and I don't presume to predict these things. But I know that many people are working really hard. What I think about what is really wonderful and hopeful about the Amendment 4 movement is that it was started by a private citizen, and I'm happy to see everyone take a hard look about the role of folks and former felons, classified felons who have paid their debt to society but are still barred from enfranchisement, right? The right to the vote. You know, again, that's another opportunity to make sure that we are not repeating the past, because we can look at many instances in our history where on the books, states had restrictions that seemed to create a vicious cycle against enfranchisement, against the ability to have the vote. And they were based on kind of like the perception that if you've committed even small crimes, that you may just be barred for a lifetime. So the conversation around what we've been for is what it means to have truly paid for your crime and whether then you can have all of the, you know, basic rights that you are entitled to as a human. And as a civil rights and human rights lawyer and as someone who really believes in the integrity of the whole human and human dignity, I have to really urge everyone to just think about the whole person and what message it sends to say someone could never be redeemed after they have truly served their time.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you if the law school, Stetson Law, has decided whether there will be in-person classes this fall and how that decision will be made.
I want to just preface this by saying that I will share whatever we've talked about openly. So, it's not like a big reveal. What I want to say is that we are very much monitoring the cases in Florida, and our hearts and prayers are with everyone who is impacted by COVID-19. My own family was impacted in New York, and we lost a dear aunt. And I know there is not one single person who is not touched personally by COVID-19. So that's really what's on our mind right now. And within that, we are building flexibility in our schedule to answer the moment and determine what is best for the community. And we'll keep everyone updated about the plans and the students. We do webinars with the students almost every week, first year, second year, and incoming. I just had a webinar with the incoming class. We also stay in communication with the board takers. We are heartened by the exam, the July board exam being online, and they are busy, right? As you can imagine, it's a very stressed cohort studying for the board, but we are very heartened to have the Florida Board of Bar Examiner and the Supreme Court really make this adjustment for students in the time of COVID. So our plans is to keep monitoring and to answer the needs of the community and to remain very much close to the heartbeat of what our law community, our alums, and everyone at this time.
Well, Dean Alexandri, thank you so much for coming on WMNF's Midpoint today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. You have great questions.
Thank you. It's very nice talking with you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, that's the Dean of Stetson University College of Law, Michelle Alexandri, talking about a new consortium for racial justice with all of the law schools in Florida. Later today, I'll post a video to our website, WMNF.org, of the full interview with Dean Alexandri. We talked about much more, including her concerns about police accountability amid a crackdown on recent demonstrations for racial justice. You are listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. It's 12:31 in the afternoon. I'm Sean Canaan. In a few minutes, we'll bring on my next guest. She's a Pinellas teacher who's concerned about the push to reopen in-person classroom education despite record coronavirus infections in Florida. And I will also be taking your calls. Are you a parent, a student, a school worker, a teacher? What do you think? The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Before I go on, I want to read a question that came in about asking the dean of the Stetson Law School how attorneys can get involved. And thanks for that email, Eugene. I will connect you offline. That was a recorded interview, so I can't ask her that right now, but I'll try to put you guys in touch with each other. So thanks for that question. Florida shattered the record for the most new cases of coronavirus in one day, with more than 15,200 recorded yesterday. That's more than any other state, including New York, during the peak of the outbreak there. About an hour ago, the state added another more than 12,000 cases from the last 24 hours. Before we bring on our next guest, let's hear a story from WFSU in Tallahassee that kind of sets the stage for our topic. Florida's Education Commissioner issued a mandate last week requiring schools to open 5 days a week in the fall. Here's the story from Ryan Daly, who has more on the reaction from education stakeholders.
Commissioner Richard Corcoran's emergency order calls on K-12 schools to provide all their usual services on brick-and-mortar campuses. The order says districts are subject to advice and orders from state and local health departments, but it also tasks schools with drawing up a reopening plan, which they are required to submit to the State Department of Education. Corcoran's move got a stamp of approval from Governor Ron DeSantis, who says he doesn't want the achievement gap to widen or to stunt learning gains.
But I also told the secretary or the commissioner of education, I said, look, you know, different parents have different calculations. If a parent wants to opt for virtual education, they should absolutely be able to do that. We shouldn't be forcing them to do any types of decisions. But I'm confident if you can do Home Depot, if you can do Walmart, if you can do these things, we absolutely can do the schools.
Frederick Ingram, president of statewide teachers union, the Florida Education Association, says teachers want to be back with their students in person, but thinks Corcoran's decision is motivated by politics.
It is ironic that the commissioner of education would, on the 20th day of the increases or sustainable positive cases of COVID-19 in the state of Florida, issues a mandate to open schools on a date certain.
Corcoran, former Republican Speaker of the Florida House, issued the order on the same day President Donald Trump tweeted, quote, schools must open in the fall. Ingram acknowledges the order does give some flexibility at the local level. It doesn't require parents to send their students back to campus, and it allows districts to receive funding for students using off-campus innovative learning.
So we believe that it does give some options to districts. You know, the mandate that it has is that schools will be open, or at least have an option for parents to choose to be open 5 days a week in the brick and mortar school. And so we always are of the opinion that local control is better.
Ingram is concerned, however, that Corcoran's order doesn't address what he anticipates will be a higher cost of operation under the new normal caused by COVID-19. North Florida Democratic State Senator Bill Montford is CEO of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents.
It's a legal issue, quite frankly, it's a constitutional issue, and that is, you know, who controls local schools? It's a very good argument. It's a very good legal question, and it extends all the way to the President of the United States when President Trump, you know, says that, you know, we're going to open schools and so on and so forth, and he's going to pressure governors and everybody else.
Montford, a former principal and superintendent, known in the Florida legislature as being one of the most plugged into issues of education, says historically local officials have final say.
And there are, you know, people on different sides of that issue, but I will tell you in the past, there's been no question that local duly elected school boards and the superintendents, whether they are duly elected or appointed, in this state, it's always been clear that they have the authority constitutionally to make the decisions what's best for their communities.
The provision regarding local and state health departments provides a level of flexibility for districts that Montford says makes him more comfortable with the move.
You know, I'm not too alarmed about it, quite frankly, because if you read it closely, what it simply says is the brick and mortar schools will open 5 days a week to be available for students. But also in that order, there was a clause in there that said, in cooperation or with advisement of the local health organizations.
He uses the example of South Florida districts that have announced their intent not to open as an example of the flexibility given by that provision.
That says, you know, we will not open up because we're still in phase one. I don't see that contrary to what the commissioner had put forth.
Montford says the order to reopen schools could become a target of litigation, but feels that shouldn't be a priority at the moment.
Some may use the word forcing school districts to open schools. Legally, that's an issue I think we can address somewhere on down the road. Again, we've got far more important issues that we need to deal with today.
Montford says chiefly among those pressing issues of today is keeping Florida's students, teachers, and school staff healthy. I'm Ryan Daly.
Well, welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan, and that report was from WFSU about the topic that we're talking about right now. Should schools reopen next month during the pandemic? And our guest right now to talk about reopening schools to in-person instruction is Pinellas school teacher Dr. Christy Faust. She's helping to organize a rally tomorrow at the Pinellas Schools office in Largo. It's called Pinellas Rally for a Safe Return to Campus. Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, Christy.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad you could join us. The rally is called Pinellas Rally for a Safe Return to Campus. It's from 9 until 11 tomorrow morning in Largo. Why are you organizing this demonstration?
I've heard a lot of concerns coming from my colleagues and coming from the community, and we want to just bring that to the school board building, both symbolically and kind of as a last show that we are concerned about the plans that they recently released.
And those plans involve that is a choice to have distance learning, to have online learning, but also the choice where parents can send their students to a classroom. But do the teachers get a choice?
I haven't been offered one as of yet. So at the very least, it's unseen, but to my knowledge, teachers have not been offered a choice.
Your demonstration is some people will be in cars, but you'll also be supporting the idea of physical distancing and using masks?
Absolutely. We definitely are a safety conscious organization. We definitely believe that masks help to keep this, to keep COVID at bay. So we'll be certainly socially distancing, you know, keeping apart from each other. And since we'll be outside, it will be easy to do that. And we're also encouraging folks to bring masks. We'll have some on hand for we'll have some available if people forget. But in general, we are expecting people to show up with masks on.
And you've been using the hashtag 14 days, no new cases. What does that mean?
So that goes back, I began looking for other people organizing to see if I could fall into their efforts, and I wasn't really finding much. So someone directed me to a petition that was made by Harley Litzelman, to change.org petition, and he wrote a very well-supported article, and in that article that he wrote and in the petition, one of the demands is 14 days with no new cases, that we wouldn't return to brick-and-mortar learning until we reached that threshold. And the reason for that threshold, especially using Florida as an example, since we are a good one right now, we basically just had a steep mountain of increases in COVID cases. Yesterday we just had 15,300-ish cases, the most in the nation in one day. With the CDC, they are recommending a 14-day decline for reopening schools and reopening different places. And since COVID started, Florida has never had that. So, as the gentleman in the article or in the interview prior to me speaking, he mentions we are in phase one. We moved to phase two, but we're not really in phase two. We're really in phase one. We've never had 14-day decline. But if we did have that here in Florida, a 14-day decline might bring us halfway down the mountain. Which, if we reopen, then we're going to just send ourselves right back up a new mountain with the increase in COVID cases because, you know, there's just going to be a lot of people interacting. They're going to be taking the infection home. So we're pushing for something that's a little more stringent with basically making sure that the pandemic is mostly over with the 14 days, no new cases, so we don't have to open schools and close schools and open them again and potentially result in more people getting sick and potentially even dying.
Our guest is Pinellas Schools teacher Dr. Christy Faust, and you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 12:42 in the afternoon. We will be taking your call shortly, 813-239-9663. If you're on the line right now, just hold on. We'll get to your call shortly. But Dr. Faust, I want to ask you, you've already done distance learning for the end of the spring semester. Tell us about that experience. What was it like distance teaching and distance learning for kids last semester?
I did. So on the pro side, I learned some new ways to be a teacher and put some more tricks in my sleeve to help with accommodations for my students and things like that. So there were definitely good parts. It's not ideal. I teach high school, and the way that I planned my lessons was to try to be as accommodating to student schedules as possible. I don't know everyone's home situation. I don't know what's going on with them. Some people were sharing devices, so maybe their elementary school sibling, you know, they had to use it at a certain time, then mom and dad needed it for work, and then finally at 10 o'clock at night they could come and do their science homework. So I tried to make my lessons asynchronous so that people could do them at any time. And I will say that with going with that model, that I feel like I lost students, that they kind of disappeared. And obviously that's not an ideal situation. We don't want folks disappearing into the cracks just because they can kind of either hide themselves or they can disappear behind a screen. But I do just want to point out, no one says that virtual learning is the answer, that it's the ideal thing. We're living in a pandemic. It's not ideal. But as far as safety, virtual is basically the only way to really help to decrease the number of COVID cases.
Our guest is Pinellas school teacher Dr. Christy Faust. She's a Pinellas teacher who's concerned about the push to reopen in-person classroom education during the height of the pandemic. And I want to find out if you're a parent, a student, a school worker, or a teacher, and what you think about this. 813-239-9663. I have an email that came in from Doug in St. Pete, and he says, my middle school and high school children will not be going back to in-person school this fall. My question for everyone is, why is the Pinellas County School Board meeting having a virtual meeting tomorrow if they're discussing the possibility of opening schools? If it's okay to open schools, which have hundreds more people, will meet for longer each day and will meet 5 days a week, shouldn't it be okay for the board to meet in person? And as you're answering this, Christy, or at least giving your opinion about this, maybe remind people that at the same time of this, as this Pinellas County School Board meeting, about your demonstration.
So I I don't think that they should be meeting in person because it's not safe for large groups of people to meet. So for the same reason, but I also hope that they keep that in mind when they put this draft of a plan to a vote. And tomorrow, folks are rallying. We are, the group that I'm working with, we are rallying at the school board building tomorrow, outside, socially distancing, masks on, to bring up those sorts of points. To make our voice heard, and to point out that there's a lot of questions for the option to go back to traditional learning for brick-and-mortar learning.
You've mentioned that you're a high school teacher. Do you want to say what high school you are coming from, and are you concerned about getting scolded by your administrators for organizing a demonstration?
I'd like to just leave it that I'm a Pinellas County teacher. I do teach at a high school, and part of that does go to that. Obviously, my administrators know who I am. I'm nervous. I'm personally nervous. Yes, I'm doing this organizing, and I think it's the right thing to do. I'm not doing it for selfish reasons. I'm doing it with my students very much in mind, my own health and my colleagues' health and everyone as well, a community health even. If schools open too early, it's going to cause more increases with COVID in the community as well. So it's certainly not any sort of selfish thing. And logically, I know I'm not doing anything wrong. But I will say, me being up front, this is my third interview today, so there ain't no way that I can distance myself from being a leader in this movement. And it's scary. I'll admit to being scared of what could happen.
So should public schools reopen next month? That's the topic we're talking about on Midpoint Monday, WMNF 88.5 FM. Our guest is Pinellas school teacher Dr. Christy Faust, and she's hosting a demonstration, helping to organize a demonstration tomorrow morning at 9 in Largo at the Pinellas schools. At the Pinellas School District, that is, to have a safe reopening, reopen schools when it's safe. But I want to find out from listeners whether you think that whether it is safe to reopen schools, public schools, next month. And we have some people on the line. Let's go now to Roseanne in Collier County. Hi, Roseanne. What would you like to say?
Yes. First, I just want to thank you for bringing up this very important topic, and I want to thank your guest so very, very much. Yes, I am also a teacher, and I'm in Collier County, and teachers' voices do need to be heard. One thing about education is there's this mantra constantly in all our trainings, everything, all the time, is to make data-driven decisions. So I just want to make the very simple point that Florida DOE has the data. The decision to reopen at all brick and mortar should not flies in the face of that data and should not be one of the options at all. Teachers are terrified. They're very nervous for their communities, for their families. It's just that these numbers are raging. And like your speaker said everything so eloquently, we should even be reopening. Collier County doesn't even have an indoor mask mandate yet. And our numbers are skyrocketing as well. So it's lots of concerns. Teachers are very, very nervous. Thank you for covering this very important issue.
Roseanne, Collier is a little bit out of my radar. Is your county, have they decided that they're going to have options for the fall, or what have they decided?
Yeah, and the options include the brick and mortar. There's also a big school board work session scheduled for tomorrow. So a lot of people are sending in their comments. But we don't have any details. And another good point your guest made is that in all this option and choices, teachers have not been made aware, and school starts to open in a few weeks, to this day have not been made aware of any options that they might have to not report to the physical building.
Yeah, those are good points, Roseanne. Thank you so much. I appreciate you calling in. And Christy, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Just that I feel with everybody across the state, I'm glad that Palm Beach County Teachers Union, that they have stood up and they ended up bargaining for their schools to open remotely, or virtually rather. So I'm hoping that other districts will follow Palm Beach County's lead. So fingers crossed, I guess, with some of that.
So if there's an option, if Pinellas, for example, does continue with having the option where there will be in-person instruction and virtual, people have talked already about, in fact, in the last hour there was discussion about this, about how you'll need additional classroom space if you're going to have physical distancing between students in classes. That would necessarily mean fewer students per classroom, and so you'll need more space. But you'll also need more teachers, because if you have more classrooms, you'll need more teachers. And also, if you have an option for virtual teaching, you'll need teachers to do that. You can't teach a full day online and teach a full day in a classroom. Has the district made any financial decisions, any way to pay for those additional teachers?
Not that I'm aware of. And the concerns about if they offer traditional and they're also offering a virtual, which would be taught by, Pinellas County teachers. Yeah, I have those same concerns about I can't do both at the same time. These sorts of things are coming up. And the teacher start date is August 3rd. Students are supposed to go back on August 12th. So some of these timelines, they just, they don't give a lot of time for adjustment at the very least.
Our guest is Dr. Christy Faust. She's a Pinellas school teacher, and we're talking about whether schools, public schools, should reopen next month in Florida. Florida is the epicenter of the pandemic in the entire globe. There's really no other state, no other small country or medium-sized country that has as many cases as Florida does right now of coronavirus. The Miami Herald reported a couple of weeks ago that according to the Florida Department of Health, more than 7,000 children under the age of 18 have tested positive for coronavirus in Florida. So if you listen to Governor DeSantis, a lot of what he says is that, there aren't that many children getting sick, and when the children do get sick, they very rarely get very sick. But still, if there's that many people, are you concerned about a sick child spreading it to you or to other children and then to their families?
Absolutely, because certainly we care about the students, and we don't want our students getting sick. A statistic I recently heard, I'm not completely sure if this is accurate, but I believe that the average age for teachers is something like over 50. So that means a lot of our teachers are in a high-risk age group already. And then, of course, we have folks of all ages who might be immune-compromised, and those sorts of things as well, or they live with someone that is that way, that may have those complications and things like that. So, and another concern that I have is the fact that it seems like COVID can be asymptomatic a lot. So we have carriers that they may never show symptoms, but they could still be passing it to folks. So it makes it even harder to gauge. Like if we take temperatures at the door, that's not going to matter for someone who's asymptomatic. So certainly, we definitely care about our students. We don't want them to get sick. We don't want them to die. We don't want them to take it home. But teachers, don't we deserve the same? And shouldn't we be sending a message that, if a student has a teacher that dies, how much trauma is that going to be for their life? So certainly that, we deserve, and we have the right to have a safe working environment. And at least right this second, right now, everything that you said about Florida, we are not at that place that it is safe for anybody to go back to brick and mortar. Any large groups of people is going to be problematic.
What happens if a student is test positive, the student that's been in class for, a day or a week or whatever, and then test positive, or if a teacher does, what happens? Do they have to isolate, the rest of the class have to isolate for 2 weeks? Does the teacher have to take sick time, or have you heard anything from the district about, from a teacher standpoint, what would happen in that situation?
Some of the guidance that we've gotten is that we would have to use like our sick time. After that was out, we would be eligible for the Family Medical Leave Act, which is unpaid time. I know since I'm new, last year was my first year in Pinellas County as a teacher. I previously worked elsewhere. So I don't have that much leave on the books. I don't even think I have 14 days. So if I had to self-quarantine once, I would use all of my paid leave. And let's just say I have another interaction with another student or something that's infected. If I'm supposed to self-quarantine again, I would have to take unpaid leave. From what I understand, this is as I understand it right now. So the idea that we would have to go towards methods to use unpaid leave, you know, we got bills. We got to pay our rent. We got to fill our refrigerators and things as well. So it definitely leaves questions, at least, that I... me and a bunch of teachers, we actually put in a list of questions to the district, and we haven't heard back yet.
Our guest is Dr. Christy Faust. She's a Pinellas school teacher, and we're talking about should public schools open next month in the coronavirus. We're going to go to the phones in just a second, but I have an email from Karen in Dunedin. She says, I'm concerned. I know my oldest wants her five-year-old to experience kindergarten, but my oldest had pneumonia last year, and my son-in-law has severe asthma. They're not following the same social distancing that I am and see me as over the top, so I just have to let them make their own choices. So that's an email from Karen in Dunedin, and I believe we have Manuel on the phone. Hi, Manuel. Welcome to the show. What would you like to say? You there, Manuel?
Hello.
Hi, is this Manuel? Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Doctor, I appreciate all the information you're giving us today. I'm a retired teacher myself. I taught for 28 years in Hillsborough County. And one of the concerns I would have for teachers like yourself would be the exposure that, like, for your family, if you have children, you're coming in contact with other children and bringing that to your home. How do most of the teachers in Pinellas County feel about that?
Well, I certainly don't want to represent, voices that I haven't been authorized to or whatever. You know, I haven't talked to a majority of Pinellas County teachers. Now, the district did put out a survey before we had our extreme spike. And I don't have the data right in front of me, but I believe both parents and teachers had more than 50% that at least expressed some sort of concern about returning. So now that we've had these spikes, I would say, you know, if they resurveyed the, you know, parents and teachers, that probably even more people would have those concerns about returning. So that's the only thing I can say. And I will say in my circle, which is probably biased, but a whole lot of folks are concerned about returning to brick-and-mortar learning.
Is there any verbiage in the contract as a teacher? Do you have any kind of verbiage that would protect for situations like this?
Honestly, it's not real strong. It just basically says that we're supposed to have two-way communication with the district on matters of safety or something to that effect. So it's a bit vague in regards to that. So.
Manuel, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate the perspective from a retired teacher. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. And I want to remind people that you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. We still probably have time for a phone call if you want to call in right now, 813-239-9663. We are asking people, should public schools reopen next month? We're talking about that on Midpoint Monday with my guest, who is a Pinellas High School teacher, Dr. Christy Faust, and she's helping to organize a meeting tomorrow, a rally tomorrow at the school board in Largo. It's for a safe reopening. And Facebook group Tampa Bay for a Safe Return to Campus lists three other demonstrations tomorrow. There's one at 2 in the afternoon in Sarasota County, at 4:45 at the Manatee County School Board, and at 5 in Lakeland there will be a car parade at the Polk County School Board meeting. So, Christy, tell us more about yours. There's going to be an American Sign Language interpreter at your rally in Largo tomorrow morning.
Yes, one of our participants was just extraordinarily generous. Well, someone brought up the issue of having ASL support, and I'm like, well, we're pretty grassroots. We're just kind of, everyone's helping out where they can, but I wasn't sure that we would be able to get that sort of support. But a generous donor is actually, they're going to be paying to bring an ASL translator to our rally. And we should be live streaming tomorrow. So, anyone who's watching who may be hard of hearing, that they'll have that support that they can tell what's being said at the rally.
And is that at the Tampa Bay for a Safe Return to Campus Facebook group that will be live streaming?
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint, Christy. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Christy Faust is a Pinellas Schools teacher, and she's helping to organize a rally tomorrow at the Pinellas Schools office in Largo. And if you want to find out more information, you can go to the Facebook page, Pinellas Rally for a Safe Return to Campus. It's from 9 until 11 in the morning. And I want to thank everyone who called in and who emailed and texted today. I want to thank my previous guest, Michelle Alexandri, from the Stetson University College of Law Dean. Thanks to Rob Lori, Frank Knox, and DT. I'm Sean Canan. Stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. I want to thank you for your financial support at WMNF.org. We're going to ask for funds tomorrow, so I appreciate your support in advance at WMNF.org. And thanks so much for listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday.